Well, do you believe that the workers can be driven to minimum subsistence if we didn't have the interventionist legislation?
Absolutely.
Why do you think it's all just words, has nothing to do with anything?
Well, doesn't it depend on what they're buying?
What do you mean, doesn't it depend on what?
If your income is, let's say your income is staying the same.
Yeah.
And then the prices are reducing.
Yeah.
Sorry, you're assuming that all prices are going down.
No, I'm not assuming that the price of each and every good is going down. I'm assuming that the general weighted average is going down. So there could be some prices that stay the same, but then others would fall that much more. There might even be some that rose, but then others would have to fall that much more.
So does that actually happen?
Well, yeah.
I mean, if you look at people in the lower incomes,
yeah,
if they're spending their money on gas and bread and milk,
yeah,
and rent,
yeah.
Not sure that over time those go down or have gone down.
All right, well, let's consider what's happened in these cases. You say gas, bread, milk. The amount of time that it takes to work to earn the price of those things, that has fallen pretty sharply. At one time, if all that people could have, when the main item of people's diets was bread, they took their whole incomes just to buy enough bread, and there was no gasoline. Where did people get the money available to buy gasoline, which implies they also have cars? So in order for people to be able to buy cars, how did that happen? Well, now, if they just made more money, it's easy. Nothing would be easier than to make everybody a millionaire. All we'd have to do is have Mr. Greenspan work a little overtime, and we could all be millionaires. You know, he has a sign, the buck starts here. He would start more bucks. So we could easily be millionaires, but prices would be correspondingly higher, so that wouldn't help. What's enabled people to buy things like automobiles and gasoline is that they devote a much smaller fraction of their budgets to food. Why do they have to devote a smaller fraction of their budgets to food? The price of food has dropped. You see, people are making more money, but that's only because there is more money. To the extent there's more money, there's also higher prices. The key question is, what is it that stops prices from rising as much as wages? What is that? What stops prices the rise in the productivity of labor? That serves to increase the supply of goods as more money is out there. So if the supply of goods rises relative to the supply of labor, the rise in the productivity of labor serves to increase the supply of goods relative to the supply of labor, which means it serves to reduce prices relative to wages. And when we have another factor, like the increase in the quantity of money, that's operating to raise everything, it will raise wages more than prices, because at the same time, the rise in the productivity of labor is reducing the rise in prices. Now, people get the money to buy gasoline because a lesser fraction of their budgets is tied up in buying the most essential necessities. And they can buy gasoline, pay rent, buy meat, have clothing. And the very, very poorest people in our society, unless they're utterly homeless, they have television sets, they have telephones, they have cell phones. The great majority of people we consider poor have some kind of automobile. They have a refrigerator, an oven, a microwave oven. So what makes it possible for them to afford these things? It's that the prices of those things are low enough relative to their wages.
How do you tie in credit into that? Because there's a lot of people that are living way beyond their means.
But yeah, there are people living beyond their means. They can only do that for a limited time. Then they'll probably have to go bankrupt. And so they wouldn't be able to buy as much as they bought if they hadn't gone into debt. Okay, anything else? The price of food is one of the things that's gone down most dramatically, and you can see evidence of that in the fact in the proportion of the labor force that's presently employed in agriculture. What is the fraction of the labor force or the whole population that's in agriculture?
Less than 1%.
Pardon me?
Less than 1%, I believe.
No, it's somewhere between 3% and 4%, I think. And there are agricultural surpluses with that. At one time, what was it?
98%.
When the United States was founded, it was 90%. What is the proportion in agriculture today in India and China? Pardon me?
60% or 70% maybe?
Yeah, on the order of 60% or 70%. I think something like 2/3 of the population still lives in rural areas. And so that's an indication of the very low productivity of labor in agriculture, that it takes that big a chunk of the labor of the population to provide the food for the whole. Okay, well, let's take the analysis to the next level. We've shown that real wages depend on the productivity of labor, which works by reducing prices relative to wages, or holding down the rise in prices relative to the rise in wages. Now, the next question is to consider what underlies the productivity of labor. Why is the productivity of labor so much higher today in the United States than in the past? What explains its rise?
Technology.
Well, the technological innovation is one major part of it, but by no means sufficient. It's necessary that the technological innovation be embodied in capital goods, and it takes capital goods to make it possible to implement the innovation.
Economic society.
At the deepest level, it's economic freedom, but let's consider the role of capital goods first. Throughout the Third World, people have at least been to movies once in a while. They've seen things on the screen. They've seen things in their personal awareness. When you have a farmer in a Third World country who was still using water buffalo to till his field, where he himself may be dragging a plow, do you think it's because he lacks the technological knowledge required to use a tractor, or couldn't acquire that technological knowledge? Do you think that what we need to do to solve the poverty of the Third World is to teach them how to use tractors? No, they already know that, or could learn it in no time at all. What is their problem? They don't have the tractors. They can't afford the tractors. They don't have the capital. They lack the capital. And in order to have the capital, it's essential that you have saving. The ability to implement more advanced technologies depends on the availability of capital. And capital depends on saving. And then once you have done some saving, and you can implement more advanced technologies, now you're in a position, you increase your total production, including the production of further capital goods. The key thing is to have more savings available to make the initial step toward taking advantage of technological progress. And then on the foundation of the more advanced methods you can use, you then produce a larger total output, which will include a larger output of capital goods. But the key is having more saving and getting more capital goods. And this depends on the way that saving brings about more capital goods is it favors their production. You see, at any given time, an economy, whatever its level, has the ability to produce either capital goods or consumers' goods. They have a certain amount of labor available. They have a certain amount of existing capital goods, maybe very primitive. With whatever labor and capital goods they have, They have the ability to produce more capital goods and less consumers' goods, or vice versa. If they're going to have capital accumulation, they have to produce more capital goods than they're using up. They have to increase their concentration on capital goods. That's what depends on saving. What will determine, for example, in our economy, the extent to which General Motors will produce trucks versus passenger automobiles? That's the relative demand. Now, does the demand for trucks, apart from personal pickups, is that coming from consumers or business firms?
Business firms.
From business firms. It depends on people abstaining from consumption, saving the funds, making them available for productive expenditure. And so General Motors or any firm, if it's able to produce either capital goods or consumers' goods, what it will do depends on the pattern of demand. If the demand for capital goods goes up and the demand for consumers' goods goes down, they concentrate more heavily on capital goods. If you have a firm which is in the consumers' goods industry and the demand for consumers' goods goes down and the demand for capital goods goes up, well, then you have to have labor and capital moving out of consumers' goods industries into capital goods industries. And that brings about a rise in the production of capital goods. When you have the additional capital goods, that serves to raise the productivity of labor. If labor works with the aid of more and better capital goods, it produces more. That's the key to raising the productivity of labor. Then, as that starts to happen, if the larger product is devoted sufficiently to the production of further capital goods, you get more capital goods, and you're off and running. Now, the extent to which an economy will concentrate on capital goods, as I say, that is based on the demand for capital goods relative to the demand for consumers' goods. And the demand for capital goods depends on saving. This is one major factor determining real wages. We can incorporate that and the other factor, which I've described as the distribution factor, being the relationship between the demand for labor and the demand for consumers' goods, which we discussed just a few minutes before the break. The distribution factor reflects how great are payrolls relative to total consumer spending. It indicates the extent to which payrolls are the source of consumption as opposed to other sources like dividends, draw, and interest. Now, if you can think back to some of the discussion last week, we dealt with Marx's capitalistic circulation. Who recalls what that was? Capitalistic circulation.
MCM prime.
The first M, can you understand as productive expenditure. That's the productive expenditure made to produce commodities in order to sell for another sum of money and a larger sum, M prime. Well, productive expenditure incorporates both the demand for capital goods and the demand for labor. The funds that business firms expend for the purpose of making subsequent sales at a profit has two main components. One is the demand for capital goods, the other is the demand for labor. And the higher the economic degree of capitalism, as expressed by the relationship between M and M prime, the greater the buying for the sake of selling relative to the sales, well, that's the higher the economic degree of capitalism. And the higher that is, the higher will be both the distribution factor, the demand for labor relative to the demand for capital goods, and also the higher will be the demand for capital goods relative to the demand for consumers' goods. And let's see if we can illustrate this with numbers. It's always the best way to do it. I'll use somewhat different numbers than I have in the text. Here we are. We have M, that's productive expenditure. M prime is the sales revenues. The economic degree of capitalism is M over M prime. The higher is that ratio, the more economically capitalistic. Why? Well, the greater is the degree of buying for the sake of selling relative to the sales revenues. I will assume, we'll examine just two hypothetical conditions. In both, we assume the total sales revenues will be the same, 1,000 units a month. In our first situation, we have a demand for labor of 200 and a demand for capital goods of 500. Now here we have sales revenues. The sales revenues reflect the demand for consumers' goods and the demand for capital goods. We show the demand for capital goods again as 500. It has to be consistent with what it was here. And we're showing the demand for consumers' goods as 500. What enables the demand for consumers' goods to be greater than the demand for labor? The wage earners are consuming their 200 of wages. Where else does the demand for consumers' goods come from? Where did it come from in Adam Smith's early and rude state of society, or in Marx's simple circulation? I'm sorry?
Price.
What do you mean the price?
Directly affects what the demand for consumer goods is.
So, excuse me?
If the price is doubled, then the demand for consumer goods is also doubled.
No, we're asking, what the source of the demand for consumers' goods was. Well, I gave you an example to work last week, I think. I don't know if we actually worked it in this class, maybe not. Okay, here was a problem to test your understanding. Yeah, we were showing a demand for consumers' goods of 500 and a demand for labor of 200. And the question was, what makes it possible for the demand for consumers' goods to be 500 when the demand for labor is only 200? Where does the additional funds come from? And then I asked, trying to track it down, where did the funds come from for the demand for consumers' goods in Marx's simple circulation? Well,
from the products produced that the people purchased.
Yeah, out of the sales proceeds. There's consumption straight out of the sales proceeds. Does all consumption take place just by payment of wages? Suppose you have someone who's, it's a one-man operation. He's producing his products, he's selling them, and he consumes out of the proceeds. Where do dividend payments come from? They come out of the sales proceeds. Where does the payment of draw by partners and proprietors come from? Out of the proceeds. These are sources of consumption that are other than wages. Now, I made the point last week that if we had no capitalistic circulation at all, if there ever were a time when Marx's simple circulation applied, all of the proceeds would be consumed. And what was the total nature of the income?
Profit.
It was all profit. There were no wages. Zero wages, all profits. No demand for capital goods. What happens when the sellers start acting capitalistically? When they start to not consume all the sales proceeds, but save some of the sales proceeds and productively expend them? The profits are going to end up going down because there's productive expenditure, which incorporates what? Which makes possible what? It includes wage payments and demand for capital goods, and both of which are going to show up as costs to be deducted from the sales proceeds and thus reduce profits. Okay, what allows consumption to be greater than wages is these other sources of consumption apart from wages, and the easiest ones to grasp are dividends and draw payments, but also interest payments as well. Now, let's look at these numbers again. here we are. We have some economic degree of capitalism. We're assuming we're at a point where the demand for labor is 200 units of money, the demand for capital goods 500, the sales revenues are 1,000, made possible by 500 of demand for capital goods, and in addition to the 200 of wage payments, which are then used to make 200 of consumption expenditure, we're assuming that this is an economy with 300 of other forms of consumption, 300 of consumption on the part of sellers of products. The sellers of products are consuming 300 of the sales proceeds. And when that 300 is added to the 200 of wage earners' consumption, we have 500 of consumption. Now, the economic degree of capitalism here is 200 plus 500 over 1,000. That's 0.7. That's the economic degree of capitalism. The distribution factor, the demand for labor relative to the demand for consumers' goods, that's 0.4, 200 over 500. All right, what happens if the system becomes economically more capitalistic? If the sellers of products decide to curtail their consumption further and save and productively expend more? So instead of personally consuming 300 out of the 1,000 of sales proceeds, they will reduce their consumption to 100. And what are they doing with the 200 that they no longer consume but are now productively expending? Well, instead of making a demand for labor of only 200, the demand for labor is now 300. Instead of the demand for capital goods being only 500, it's now 600. So notice we have a higher economic degree of capitalism, 900 over 1,000, 3 plus 6, that's 900, and the 4 plus 6, that's 1,000. The economic degree of capitalism has risen. What's the effect on the distribution factor? Yes? I'm sorry? It's gone from 200 over 500, or 0.4, to 300 over 400, that's 0.75. As far as wages depend on the distribution factor, as far as real wages depend on the distribution factor, what's happened to them? If real wages are the product of the distribution factor times the productivity of labor, and now the distribution factor has increased, what's the effect on real wages? They have gone up. What is the relationship on between profits and wages? In our first sequence, sales revenues were 1,000. What would cost be if productive expenditure is 700? What are costs going to be? If business firms are spending 700 to take in 1,000, what will be their costs? Yes? If firms are spending 700 to bring in 1,000, what will be their costs? 700. What will be their profits?
300.
Okay. Now, if they're spending 900 to bring in 1,000, what will be, and now 300 are wages out of that 900, 200 out of the 700 are wages, but 300 out of the 900 are wages, and there's demand for capital goods of 600, what will be costs and what will be profits? If they're spending 900 to bring in 1,000, what will be costs? 900. What will be profits? 100. And what will be wages? 300. And what's the relationship between wages and profits? 50.
Wages and profits.
Yes? 3 to 1 instead of 2 to 3. So here we are. The higher the economic degree of capitalism, the greater our wages relative to profits, and also the greater our wages relative to consumption. The distribution factor rises in favor of the wage earners. But what is most important is the rise in the demand for capital goods relative to the demand for consumers' goods. Because how will this affect the relative production of capital goods and consumers' goods?
It's going to go up.
The demand for capital goods increase, demand for consumer goods decrease.
And so how will that affect the extent to which they're produced?
Increased production of capital.
I mean, there'll be a rise in the production of capital goods. Labor and capital will be shifted out of the production of consumers' goods into the production of capital goods. The supply of capital goods will be increased. And when the supply of capital goods increases, what is the effect on the productivity of labor? And we have the average worker now working with the aid of more and better capital goods. What should that do to his productivity? It should increase it. Are you aware of the relationship between the productivity of labor and the supply of capital goods? Why is the productivity of labor so much higher in the United States than in India or most of China?
Is the higher economic capitalism?
Well, that's a deeper cause, but the more immediate cause is the greater supply of capital goods. What difference does it make to the productivity of labor in agriculture if in one case you're farming with oxen or human muscles versus you're using tractors and harvesters? The latter is obviously more productive. What difference does it make if you're making building materials, having to chop trees down by hand with axes and then saw the logs into planks with hand saws versus you're using very sophisticated power tools. You can hoist giant logs with cranes onto flatbed trucks or railroad cars. You have sawmills with huge blades that slice up giant trees into neat planks. What difference does this make to the productivity of labor? Obviously, it depends on the kind of capital goods. Now, in the more advanced countries, it's this type of more advanced and more abundant capital goods, case by case, that underlies the higher productivity of labor and the more abundant supply of consumers' goods in those countries relative to the supply of labor. And it's the availability of capital goods that is the immediate cause of the rise in the productivity of labor. But the cause of the capital goods is, in large measure, the relative demand for capital goods, the demand for capital goods relative to the demand for consumers' goods. See, what's happening to whatever capital goods we have? What's happening to the supply of flour as we produce bread?
It's being used up.
It's used up. What's happening to the flour mill? What's happening to steel mills, automobile plants, as we use them and as time passes? They're being used up too. They wear out, they get older. And what do we have to do if we're going to maintain the supply of capital goods? We have to produce at least replacements. We have to devote an awful lot of our productive effort just to replacing all of the capital goods used up. And if we're to have capital accumulation, we have to devote more effort than that to producing capital goods. We have to devote a proportion of effort to capital goods that exceeds the maintenance proportion. We have to devote a proportion of our labor and existing capital goods to the production of capital goods that is greater than required merely to replace them. Then we'll produce more capital goods than we use up. Then we have capital accumulation. Then we have a greater ability to produce because now we've got better, more and better capital goods. And if we continue to devote a sufficiently high proportion to the production of capital goods, we can have capital accumulation going on year after year. You can think of this in really pretty simple terms, in terms of an isolated, self-sufficient farmer. The principle will be there. What's the main capital good for a self-sufficient farmer? What is it that he uses up and has to continually replace?
Seed.
His seed. He plants seed. Where does he get his replacement seed?
From the crop.
All right, now, let's imagine we had a farmer. He plants one bushel of seed. He gets two bushels of crop. What does that imply about the proportion of his crop that he needs to devote to seed merely to replace the seed used up?
50%.
50%. Okay. For him to have capital accumulation, he'd have to devote something more than 50% to seed. If he devotes 55%, well, then he gets more seed the next year than he used up this year. What does that do to the size of crop he could produce the year after? They produce a larger crop. Now, the situation of an economy as a whole is very analogous to the self-sufficient farmer. The economy as a whole is self-sufficient. The economy as a totality is self-sufficient. And here we are, we're using up not simply seed, we're using up automobile factories, steel mills, flour, steel sheet, etc., etc. What is the physical source of replacement? Well, it's the economy's own production. Just like the farmer replaces his seed out of the crop, we replace our capital goods out of our total physical product. And if we're to have capital accumulation, we have to devote a larger chunk of our total product to capital goods than is required merely to replace them. So if our replacement proportion were 50%, we would need to devote, let's say, 60% to capital goods. In that case, we'd have more capital goods next year than we had this year. And what should that enable us to do next year? If we have significantly more capital goods, this would imply, I think, 20% more capital goods. If we've got 20% more capital goods, because we've substantially increased our concentration on their production, what should that enable us to do next year in terms of what we can produce? Who should be able to produce substantially more? And in the chapter, I assume 20% more. Well, if we have the ability to produce 20% more, and we continue the same higher relative concentration on capital goods, we should be able to produce a further 20% more. And on that way. So if we have this capital accumulation going on due to the rise in the relative demand for capital goods, what would be the effect on the productivity of labor as the years go by? It would be growing. It would be rising. We'd have a rising productivity of labor. And this is a key way that the productivity of labor is put into a rising situation. We have a rise in the demand for capital goods relative to consumers' goods. People become more future-oriented. They want to make more provision for the future. They save and invest more heavily. That raises the demand for capital goods relative to the demand for consumers' goods. Whatever limited ability to produce we start off with, we devote it more heavily to capital goods. We now have more capital goods than we did before, which enables us to produce more the next year than we could this year. And what will keep the wheels going is if we have technological progress. What will keep the process lubricated, as it were. We'll be in a position to take advantage of better and better technologies as our supply of capital goods augments. And the existence of technological progress will serve to maintain the ability to increase output. And at the same time, the wage share is higher. The distribution factor has been elevated. There's an elevation of the distribution factor, and the productivity of labor is rising. So what's happening to real wages? Yes? Real wages will be progressively rising. We'll have the distribution factor has been increased. B, the productivity of labor is rising. Now, all of this is in point six. Thus, the higher is the wage share of consumption, and the more rapidly rising the productivity of labor because of the higher capital goods share of total output. This is the result of a higher economic degree of capitalism. Now, I make a further point in A that the increase in the supply of capital goods and the rise in the productivity of labor also depends on the efficiency of the economic system, the productivity of capital goods. You can understand the productivity of capital goods in terms of the ratio of output to the supply of capital goods. How much product can we get relative to the supply of capital goods? We can illustrate the concept in terms of our farmer example. We assume we had a farmer. He had a bushel of seed as his capital good. He got 2 bushels of crop. Well, that's one productivity of capital goods. You get 2 units of output for 1 unit of capital goods. Suppose that farmer could become more efficient. Suppose he had a higher productivity of capital goods. Imagine with 1 bushel of seed, he could get 4 bushels of crop. That's something that's possible, isn't it? Well, if he could succeed in doing that, what would be implied about the proportion of his output that he needed for replacement? How large would the fraction of output now be sufficient to replace the bushel of seed used up to produce it?
One fourth.
It used to be one half, but if he can produce twice as much per unit of capital goods as he could before, that means that he can replace the capital goods with a smaller fraction of output. And what should this do to his ability to accumulate capital goods? Before, if he had been devoting half of his output to capital goods, he would merely have replaced. He'd have taken a half of his 2 bushels of crop and replaced the 1 bushel of seed. But if he's in a position to double his output to 4 bushels of crop, and he continues to devote half of that doubled crop to seed, how much seed will he now have?
Double the quantity.
He'll have 2 bushels instead of 1. Now he has capital accumulation with a concentration on capital goods that used to be sufficient merely for replacement. So notice, the more efficient the system becomes, the easier it becomes to have capital accumulation. Capital accumulation depends really on 2 things. There's the demand for capital goods relative to the demand for consumers' goods. That's one critical element. There's also the productivity of capital goods. The productivity of capital goods depends on things like technological progress. It also depends very, very vitally on economic freedom. Technological progress itself depends on economic freedom. The freer is the economy, the greater is going to be the ratio of output to the units of capital goods used up. The incentives work that way, and every factor works in that direction. And we'll take some examples in reverse, indicating things that are presently holding down the productivity of capital goods. How many of you have driven by gas stations with all of their tanks torn up? All of their underground storage tanks torn up and have to be replaced. I think everyone has seen that. Now, they've had to do this to satisfy the demands of the environmentalists. It's assumed that unless they have like double-hulled tanks, there's some danger of leakage. And the environmentalists are vitally concerned with every possible negative impact on the environment. And they think if any little bit of gasoline might escape, this has to be stopped at all costs. But along the way, they don't seem to have paid very much attention to any economic impact. What is the implication if we now have to have twice the investment in gasoline storage tanks? Does it enable them to service any greater volume of cars?
No.
What's the implied effect on the ratio of capital to output, on the supply of capital goods required to the output that the service stations are capable of producing?
Increasing the need for capital goods.
It's increasing the capital goods relative to the output, or equivalently reducing the output relative to the capital goods. If you translated it into our farmer example, what would the translation look like? If here we are, we started off, our farmer is producing 4 bushels of crop for 1 bushel of seed, and now we impose various such environmental regulations on him, what's going to be the effect on the ratio of seed he'll need to the output he produces?
Reduce crop, more seed,
reducing the productivity of capital goods. Now, this has been a pretty widespread phenomenon. It's not just the gas stations. There's metal smelters, paint shops, mining operations of all kinds. It's a very widespread phenomenon. And there are other regulations that raise costs, too. Now, what do you think is the impact of labor unions on the ratio of output relative to the amount of capital and labor required.
Reduced output,
again, and requiring more labor and capital goods relative to the unit of output. So, again, in our farmer example, it's going from 4-1 down to a lesser ratio. And even the antitrust laws work in that direction. Imagine you have two firms, they're both contemplating the adoption of some kind of machine or improved process, but if either one of them alone adopted it, they wouldn't be able to use it to any great degree of its capacity. Maybe if one firm did it, they'd operate this new process to only 40% of its capacity. That's not enough to make it pay. But if the two firms merged, they could operate it to 80% of its capacity. If they're prohibited from merging, what is the effect on the productivity of capital goods? Well, it's held down. You're prevented from taking advantage of this improvement. To the extent that you have high taxes on profits, what's the incentive to become more efficient? What's the effect on the incentive to become more efficient? It's lessened. And to the extent those taxes are used in any part to subsidize inefficient operations, well, that's enabling the inefficient operations to continue. These are factors holding down the productivity of capital goods. And then the whole tax system. Just think, suppose we did not have the corporate income tax. Imagine by some miracle the government found ways to reduce its budget by an amount equal to the corporate income tax and then abolish the corporate income tax. What do you think the firms would be doing with a large chunk of the money they presently pay in the corporate income tax? They'd be saving and reinvesting it. What would that do to the demand for capital goods relative to the demand for consumers' goods? They would be raising it. The government is a consumer. That consumption of the government would be gone. To the extent the firm saved and productively expended those proceeds, the demand for capital goods would be greater. And also, to some degree, the demand for labor would be greater, and the wage share would be greater, too. Now, what if the government could reduce its spending still further and abolish the inheritance tax? When people have to pay the inheritance tax, where do they get the money? They have to sell part of the estates. Well, I think we already went into this in week 10, perhaps, or 9, that inheritance taxes impact capital. They're at the expense of funds that otherwise would be saved and productively expended. What does an inheritance tax arrangement do to the demand for capital goods relative to the demand for consumers' goods compared with not having an inheritance tax? It will reduce the demand for capital goods relative to the demand for consumers' goods. Suppose the government's budget could be cut still further and eliminate all of the income tax brackets above 15%. What do you think would be done with a large portion of the funds that are presently paid in personal income taxes?
Spent? Consumers?
Well, some part would be spent by consumers. But what about, I would think the higher the brackets, the greater the proportion saved and reinvested. And finally, what would be the effect if the government spending were cut even a little bit further and the capital gains tax were abolished? Again, the same story. So if we wanted to have a society with the most rapid rise in real wages, which would depend on the most rapid rise in the productivity of labor, which in turn depends on the greatest concentration on the production of capital goods and the most efficient use of capital goods, what would be the implied economic policy? If our goal is to raise the real wages of the average worker as rapidly as possible, what economic policy measures, if the theoretical analysis is correct, what economic policy measures would follow? Radically reduce the government intervention, radically reduce government spending, and radically reduce taxes, especially those that fall on any kind of saving and capital accumulation. And roll back all the government intervention to make possible a great increase in the productivity of capital goods. Now, I'll briefly discuss this next point, the futility of anything but a rise in the productivity of labor as a cause of higher real wages. There's no great difficulty in raising money wages. All you have to do is increase the quantity of money. But what good does that accomplish? Everyone could earn double, triple, 100 times as much money as he now earns. Just by printing more money. Would that be the way to do it?
No.
That would be absolutely useless. It would actually be worse, much worse than useless. It would be very terribly harmful. It would have all of the very bad consequences of inflation. Now, there's another way to raise money wages apart from increasing the quantity of money. One way would be if there were a decline in the size of the working population. Suppose we pass legislation prohibiting married women from working, or raising the entry age of employment from 18 to 25. These would be ways of reducing the supply of labor. And if these laws were enforced, what would be the effect on money wage rates? You really don't know? I hear an increase and someone said a drop.
Real wage decrease.
I'm asking about money wages.
Money
wage rates would increase. Money wages would increase. But what would happen to production? That would decrease, and so prices would rise. And now, what would be implied if we have millions of people who are able and willing to work and who want to work, but we're prohibiting them from working? What effect does that have on the extent of division of labor? That would reduce it. And what effect should we expect that should have on the productivity of labor?
Reduce.
Hold it down. Reduce it. And to the extent that we stop, particularly to the extent that we would stop all married women from working, well, there are many who might make some major contributions to production. In improving the methods of production, such examples as Martha Stewart. She has a positive impact on the productive process. If she were prohibited, then to the extent the areas that she's involved in would be less well provisioned. And there might be more important cases than that. The lady who's running Hewlett-Packard, she evidently is doing some good work there.
Carly
Fiorina, I think her name is, yeah. So if she were barred from the labor force, those innovations would be lost. But what is the general effect of such developments, where you prevent people who can make a serious contribution from doing it? What's the effect on the productivity of labor? It's held back, less than it otherwise would be. So while money wages would go up, real wages would go down. And real wages, of course, would go down from inflation. Well, how else can you raise money wages other than increasing the quantity of money, other than reducing the supply of labor? There's, as far as I can see, there's only one other possible way, which also doesn't do any good, and that is to attempt to increase the demand for labor at the expense of the demand for capital goods. If the money spent in buying capital goods were less and those funds were spent in paying wages, wage rates would be higher. But again, the end result would be that prices would rise in greater degree than wage rates. Just think, if wage rates go up and if the rate of profit is unchanged, that alone implies that prices go up in proportion to wage rates. But if at the same time the productivity of labor goes down, and it would because there's less demand for capital goods, that means that prices go up more than wage rates. So that's not a good method either. In fact, there's only one way, and this is point D, the only way that money wage rates can rise, and the rise represents a gain to the wage earners, is if and to the extent that the rise in demand for labor takes place at the expense of the consumption of the non-wage earners. To the extent that the sellers of products would consume less and save and productively expend more, and some of their greater productive expenditure is a demand for labor. That's the only way. We've seen how that works, but it's important to realize that such a thing would represent a limited one-shot rise in real wages. And in any case, you can't obtain it by force. I think we've been over this ground earlier in the term, week 9, I think. Suppose the government wanted to adopt a measure limiting the consumption of all businessmen and capitalists, or limiting their incomes. Suppose, first, it limits their incomes. It says, it follows a prescription of Ralph Nader made a few years ago. It wants to limit the after-tax income of everyone to perhaps 10 times the income of a worker earning the minimum wage. So Gates' after-tax income is going to be $100,000 a year, perhaps, something in that area. Okay, what would be the effect of such a thing?
Decrease
innovation. But now, to the extent that Gates continues to have any substantial net worth, if his income in a given year were $100,000, do you think he'd have to go around with a tin cup? Do you think his lifestyle would be suddenly utterly destroyed if he's still worth several billions? What would be the foundation of his consumption? His reduced income? Or would it be his continuing substantial capital? His substantial capital. So what would be the effect of limiting his after-tax income while his consumption proceeds on the foundation of his capital? What would be the effect on capital accumulation? This would be a measure causing capital decumulation. Well, if you don't want the limitation on income to result in capital decumulation, we have to also limit the capitalist's consumption. And suppose you're attempting to limit their consumption. Well, if that's going to be something that stays in force, then what is the effect on the significance of owning the capital or of accumulating it in the first place? Suppose we had laws which said no one could consume more than $100,000 a year, and you can make that $100,000 on the foundation of $2 million in capital at 5%. $2 million in municipal bonds at 5% will give you $100,000. And let's say, okay, you want $5 million to have a buffer. But if you started off, you have a billion, what have we done to the value of $995 million out of the initial billion? What's happened to the importance of owning it? If you can't consume any more, then corresponds to the income on a small fraction of it. There's no motivation to accumulate it. There's no motivation to maintain it. So what would happen to the output of the economy? And real wages. They'd be radically reduced. They'd have all of the chaos of socialism. So these measures are not a way to raise the standard of living. The only way that a rise in the demand for labor operates to the benefit of wage earners is to the extent it's a result of a voluntary increase in saving and provision for the future. And if you want people to do that, you have to. What will lead people to want to save and invest more heavily is what attitude toward property rights? Respect the property rights. Do not attempt to have confiscatory taxation, socialization, all kinds of government takings. If you have an economy that respects property rights, private property rights, and an economy that has economic freedom, those are the foundations, those are the deepest foundations for rising real wages. That's the ultimate foundation. That's the basis of the high distribution factor, and more importantly, a high productivity of capital goods and a high demand for capital goods relative to consumers' goods, and thus capital accumulation and the rising productivity of labor. Now, the productivity theory of wages, the recognizing that what determines real wages is first and foremost the productivity of labor, this provides a full, sufficient explanation of the miserably low standard of living of the late 18th and early 19th centuries, and why the standard of living improved. The usual fairy tale that is taught is that the standard of living was miserably low because the greedy capitalists had an unchecked reign. There were no labor unions to stop them, no government intervention. They could just pursue their greed. And that allegedly was why wages were so low, conditions so bad, hours so long, etc., etc., the whole bit. Now stop to think about that for a moment. This is an argument, the distribution of wealth was unjust. Do you think that the average worker of 1800 lacked a television set, a refrigerator, a gas stove, a microwave oven, an automobile, antibiotics, motion pictures, all the rest of it? Because all of those goods were courted by the capitalists. The capitalists had them all. They didn't exist. Do you think that the average person had such a low, miserable diet because they had an abundance of food, but the capitalists were eating it all?
No.
That's ridiculous. Why was there so little wealth to go around per capita? Because there was such a low productivity of labor, so little was produced. How much difference could it have made had you had a perfectly equal distribution of wealth and income, assuming you might have achieved it? Would that have given anyone a television set, a refrigerator, any farm products produced with tractors or harvesters? It would not have given anything of any significance to anybody. Well, what was it that brought about improvement? Well, it was the fact that perhaps for the first time in human history, in a very small part of the world, in Great Britain and British North America, property rights came to be sufficiently respected that people didn't have to worry about an envious government or their neighbors seizing their property. They developed the long-term incentives to save and invest. This raised the demand for capital goods relative to consumers' goods, also raised the demand for labor relative to the demand for consumers' goods. This is the higher economic degree of capitalism. And they had a very great degree of economic freedom. There was very, very little government intervention. So what did that do to the productivity of capital goods? It meant for a very high productivity of capital goods. And they were producing, they were concentrating on the production of capital goods substantially in excess of replacement requirements. So they had capital accumulation. And they had technological progress. What was the motive to technological progress? Well, think of the dynamic aspects of the uniformity of profit principle. What do you have to do to make an exceptional profit? Introduce newer, better products, improve the methods of production. So this was the foundation for searching out and implementing more advanced technologies. This was the basis of the rise in the productivity of labor. The hated, greedy capitalist pigs were the people investing in factories, constructing the factories, and making possible the output of the factories for the masses. The first major industry was cotton textiles. For the first time in human history, the average person in the Western, in Britain and North America, was able for the first time to get new underwear. And then we had the improvements in agriculture and transportation, all kinds of new products, one after the other. And so real wages and the productivity of labor rose. And it rose on a foundation of economic freedom and respect for property rights. Now, if you see the connection between real wages and the productivity of labor, here we are, we have the underlying foundations of the rise in real wages, economic freedom, and property rights. If you grant that the rise in the productivity of labor does raise real wages, then it's possible to understand how and why the hours of work shortened. The usual fairy tale is that the government decided people were working too long and it decreed shorter hours. And so the people thereafter worked fewer hours. The way the alleged liberals understand things is the government decrees shorter hours, and at what expense does this come? Well, I'm asking, how do the liberals, in quotes, perceive this? at what expense do they think it takes place?
Capitalist.
At the capitalist. It's tantamount to a reduction in surplus labor time and surplus value, i.e. profits. That's how they see it. They think the government decrees shorter hours, and then the happy people work shorter hours, and everything proceeds as it otherwise would, except the people are able to work less. Well, suppose the government were to decree a 30-hour week. I mean, if all it takes is government decree, why not a 30-hour week? Why not a 20-hour week? What do you think would happen if we worked 3/4 as much? Well, with the same output, let's say we have the same output per hour. With the same output per hour, but working 3/4 the hours, what would happen to the total output? It would decrease by 25%. If we did 3/4 the work with the same output per unit of labor, we'd have 3/4 the output. Now, what would that do to prices? If we had the same spending to buy 3/4 the output, what would happen to prices? The price would go up in the ratio of 4-3. We'd have 4/3 the prices. Now, the unions think that everything would be settled because what they would like at the same time, along with the shortening of the week, is what? Higher hourly wages to leave weekly wages unchanged. They think, okay, we'll work fewer hours and we'll have weekly wages unchanged. Now, the great joke is that if we had an unchanged volume of payrolls, if there were unchanged payrolls, and there are now 3/4 the hours offered, only 3/4 the hours of work offered for unchanged payrolls, what would happen to hourly wage rates? How much would hourly wage rates rise if there's 3/4 the number of hours being sold for the same total payrolls?
1/4.
Well, there we go. You'd have one, the unchanged total payrolls, take that as one, divided by 3/4 the number of hours. What's 1/3?
4/3.
So hourly wage rates would go up in the ratio of 4-3, and the unions would feel very happy. But they shouldn't have a party yet, because what has happened to the work week? If that's 3/4, if you have 3/4 the work week and 4/3 the hourly wages, what's happened to the weekly wage?
Unchanged.
That's unchanged. But what happens to prices if we have 3/4 the output and unchanged spending to buy the output? Prices are 4/3 higher and you have unchanged weekly incomes. So what's happened to real weekly wages? They're only 3/4 as much. Now, isn't this a terrible shock? You work 3/4 and you end up with 3/4. That's unfair. Now, suppose such legislation had been enacted not in 2004, but in 1804. What would have happened had the, let's assume in 1804, they still had an 80-hour week. Suppose the government had decreed a 40-hour week in 1804. Why were people working an 80-hour week? Why would you work an 80-hour week? If you had a desperate need for the money. Now, you would have a desperate need if in working 40 hours, you would not be able to earn enough to stay alive. Our first need is to stay alive. And if it takes 80 hours a week to do that, we'll do that until we drop dead. So people were working 80 hours a week because in the conditions of the early 19th century, that was necessary in order to earn enough to stay alive. Now, what made that necessary? Was this a decree of the evil capitalists? Did they say, we hate people so much, we're going to make them work 80 hours?
No.
Why were people working 80 hours? Can you connect it to any other fact that you should know? What major fact would imply a need for horrendously long hours of work?
Lower real wages.
Minimum subsistence.
Well, what underlies minimum subsistence? The productivity of labor was miserably low. If you have a low output per hour of labor, but you have certain minimal requirements that you must meet or die, but what will you have to do to be able to live if you produce very little per hour? They have to work longer hours. And the same cause explains why children were working. They needed all the available labor to compensate for the low output per hour of labor. And why was the output of per hour of labor so low? Well, when was the first steam engine invented? I think in 1776. As late as 1820, in all of Great Britain, there were still only about 300 steam engines in use. When did electricity get invented or become commercially feasible? I think not until the 1880s. Well, before you could have steam engines, before you had electric power, all that by itself, what does that imply about the productivity of labor? It's extremely low. And so in order to have enough to live, people had to compensate with very long hours of labor and turn to their children for help even. Well, what is it that made possible the shortening of hours? The shortening of hours was the result of the rise in real wages, which in turn rested on a rise in the productivity of labor. And it's not difficult to understand the process. Suppose we start out in 1800, you need to work 80 hours a week just to survive. You're barely surviving. But now we have a generation of significant progress, thanks precisely to the activities of the hated capitalist pigs. And so perhaps by 1825 or so, the productivity of labor is now double. And so if you continue to work 80 hours a week, you're no longer making just subsistence, you're making twice the level of minimum subsistence. You have some margin of comfort. Well, in this very changed environment, there will be many people who start to think, while I certainly want the higher standard of living, I also don't want to kill myself with 80-hour weeks. If people can earn twice subsistence in 80 hours, that means that they're also in a position to get by with 7/8 of twice subsistence if they work 70 hours. So there are people who can now afford the comparatively lesser earnings of a 70-hour week instead of an 80-hour week. A key point to keep in mind is, other things being equal, if you work fewer hours, what does that do to your real wages? The fewer hours you work, other things being equal, the less your real wages, right? All right, now, it's one thing to work 70 hours when the output of 80 hours is required to produce the indispensable minimum just to stay alive. Then working 70 hours is not an option. But if you reach the point where working 80 hours is now producing twice subsistence, then 70 hours does become an option. With 70 hours, you can earn 2 × 7/8. You can earn 1 3/4 of subsistence instead of subsistence. You can have twice subsistence with 80 hours or 1 3/4 of subsistence with 70 hours. Well, what happens if a substantial number of people start to prefer the shorter hours? What happens anytime substantial numbers of people would start to prefer one occupation to another? Think back now to our discussion of how wage rates are determined.
People in one industry go to another. And then the capitalists would have to take their
labor and
have to invest enough hours.
What would be the effect on the wages that you could offer to attract labor? Imagine, suppose you're a businessman and you realize more and more workers want a shorter work week. And they can afford, this is what they want, and they'll accept less money. If this is a serious desire, what happens if for working 70 hours a week, they're prepared to accept not 7/8, but even a little bit less than 7/8? They become willing to accept 80% or a little more than 80% of the wages. They'll work 87.5% of the time, and they're prepared to do it for less than 87.5% of the pay. Well, what does that do to your unit labor costs? Yes? It would decrease them. And you see, what's implied here is that as a substantial number of workers, as substantial numbers of workers prefer jobs with shorter hours, that will introduce a discount into their wage rates, and by the same token, a premium into the wage rates of jobs with longer hours. In order to get people to work the longer hours, they have to pay them more than the people with shorter hours. So what incentive does that provide to employers in determining the work week?
The longer the work week would equate to would require higher wages.
Yeah, the longer work week becomes the more expensive work week. It becomes more economical to start shortening the work week. And this is how the market shortens it. You see, once you have large numbers of workers who are first put in the position in which they can afford to work fewer hours, because they can now take a reduction in wages from a substantially higher base. The rise in the productivity of labor has put them well above subsistence. So now they can afford some reduction from that higher base. These are people in a position to start working shorter hours. And if this is what they truly want, all that has to happen is for their wages to go to any kind of discount beyond the shortening of time, and then you're getting them at a lower cost. And so this is what makes the market actually offer it. This is how the market is led to shorten the work week. The length of the work week is determined by the preferences of the wage earners taken en masse. It won't be determined by the preferences of individual workers. A very good analogy that Mises uses is to the timetable of a railroad. A railroad is basing its timetable. It runs trains to accommodate traffic. It accommodates the preferences of the great bulk of the travelers, not isolated individuals. It's the same with the length of the work week. Now, what determines whether or not children work, or the extent to which they work? Who makes that decision outside of the case of orphan children?
The parents.
Well, as the parents earn more, as their real earnings go up, what happens to their need to send their children to work? That goes down. And throughout the 19th century, the age at which child labor began progressively rose. And it's been rising ever since. It went from maybe 4 in 1790 in some cases. Today, it's in many cases, it's 25. And this is the result of the rise in the productivity of labor and the rise in the real wages of the parents. Now, also, working conditions. There are two categories of improvements in working conditions, such as lighting, air conditioning, whatever. There are sometimes when the improvements in conditions pay for themselves. Like if you can introduce electric light into a factory, unless the cost of the electric light is stupendous, it will almost certainly pay to do it just because the workers can see better. You'll have fewer wasted, destroyed materials, fewer accidents, much fewer disruptions. So even though many people might have the idea that employers will never introduce an improvement if it makes life more comfortable for the workers, certainly if it pays to do it, they'll do it the same way they introduce any kind of improvement in efficiency. But besides that, there are improvements that do not pay for themselves. There are improvements that merely make life more comfortable for the wage earners, but at least at a given time, don't pay for themselves. Now, the wage earners can have such improvements, and the market has a relatively simple mechanism for seeing that they're introduced. And again, it's the issue of premiums and discounts in wage rates. And let's work with the example of air conditioning. Let's imagine, for the sake of illustration, that the cost of installing an air conditioning system in a hot workplace in the summertime, to have it available in the summer heat, let's suppose the cost works out to be $5 per worker per week. That's the cost of having the air conditioning system. But we'll assume that for whatever reason, it just doesn't add to efficiency. Probably it would, but we'll assume that there's a $5 per worker per week cost that is not covered by any improvement in worker efficiency. Now this doesn't mean that the workers can't have it. They could have it, but if they have it, what is the effect on the cost of employing them?
Increases.
It raises the cost of employing them by $5. How does this differ from the workers getting a $5 per hour or $5 per week wage increase? It doesn't. It's the same thing, but they could have it. Now, what would make it worthwhile to have it would be suppose the employer, by expending these $5 to install the improvement, the air conditioning, suppose as the result of doing it, he could obtain his workers for $10 a week less.
And he makes
then he's ahead, it pays him positively to do it. Now, if we're looking at today's conditions in a place like the United States, if you have jobs available to you at a high level of real wages, and one job is available that requires that you work through the summer in absolutely miserable sweatbox conditions, and the other is that you'll work comfortably in nice air conditioning, and here you are, your base wage is roughly $1,000 a week. Well, where would you rather work? Work where you are at $1,000 a week, or work and you don't have air conditioning, or work somewhere else where they do, and you'll make $990 a week. Have the air conditioning. Now, the employer who doesn't want to put in the air conditioning, he'll have to pay the $10 extra per week, and probably a lot more in our circumstances. So if you want to attract workers, what do you have to do? They have to offer them that. You have to offer them a whole package that they'll judge to be satisfactory. Now, these are improvements that are at the expense of what they might have as take-home pay, but they're willing to endure it because they still have sufficiently high take-home pay. Now, there are other places where conditions are much, much worse. Suppose we shift the example to Bangladesh, perhaps, and assume that the whole pay of a worker in present-day Bangladesh, his whole weekly pay is $20 to start with. And he could have air conditioning for $5 a week, but it would require that he take a $5 per week reduction in take-home pay. Well, do you think that would be a good bargain? I think in his circumstances, there are things he values far above the air conditioning, such as food for his children. So what would be the effect if we required that, suppose we had a global office of labor standards, and we require that everywhere in the world, all the workplaces be air conditioned. What would be the effect on the workers in Bangladesh?
A better quality of work environment.
Pardon me?
They have better work environment.
Unemployment.
And they'd have starvation. Or, either way, I suppose, here we are, we impose this additional cost. What are we doing to the wage rates that the employers have to pay in Bangladesh?
Increase.
Well, here they are, they're making $20 a week. Now we require that on top of that, you spend the $5 a week for air conditioning.
So to offset that, we have to increase their wages.
If the wages don't fall, then you have unemployment, and then the unemployed are starving altogether. In order to avoid the unemployment, in order to have the same workers employed, you need the same wage rates, but what has to give now? If part of the wage is the $5 air conditioning cost? Well, then it's the take-home wage. The take-home wage falls from 20 to 15. Is that what they want? Is that good from their point of view? Does it make sense to compel by law someone to have air conditioning and be hungry? But it's that example is the nature of forced improvements. See, the usual view is the government has the working conditions fairy. The government enacts a law, and then conditions improve, and who bears the cost? Well, according to the fairy tale, it comes out of the company, out of the capitalist profit, out of surplus labor time, surplus value. It's the Marxist interpretation. That's the liberal view, in quotes. But the reality is that it's coming out of the hides of the wage earners. It's not coming out of profits. Well, the upshot is that all of these measures, maximum hours legislation that's forcing people to do less work than they judge they need to do, prohibitions on child labor when people are generally poor, that's forcing poor people to be still poorer. Compulsory improvements in conditions are forcing people either to be unemployed or to have lower take-home pay. Let's turn to some other popular measures, above all labor unions. There it's widely believed that the unions decree higher wages, and this is as though the necessary labor time is increased, the surplus labor time will be decreased. Voila, everything is improved. Well, the actual effect is if the unions exist in just a few industries and they raise wage rates, what happens to the quantity of labor demanded in those industries? There'll be a decrease in the quantity of labor demanded in the unionized industries. Now, where do the workers go who would have been employed in those industries at free market wage rates, but who now can't be at the higher wage rates imposed by the unions? They have to go into other lines. Now, what is required for those other lines to be able to absorb them? Pardon me? For wage rates in these other lines to be lower. The other lines could absorb the workers displaced from the unionized lines, but only if wage rates in those areas fell. Now, if things stopped there, what we'd have is the unions would succeed in raising wage rates for their members, the members who kept their jobs anyway, but also would reduce wage rates in the non-union lines. And this is also the effect of licensing legislation. Licensing legislation raises the incomes of the license holders, but what about the people who would have pursued those occupations, but who can't because they don't have the license? Where are they now? They're in other lines, and what is required to absorb them in other lines? The wages are correspondingly reduced elsewhere. Now, suppose the unions control every industry. So all branches of the economy are subject to the higher union wage rates. Well, then the effect is going to be widespread unemployment, particularly if it's coupled with the minimum wage legislation. If you are raising wage rates throughout the whole economy, then you're reducing the quantity of labor demanded across the board below the supply available, and you have permanent institutional unemployment. And then, of course, the people who have kept their jobs, their earnings are reduced to the extent that they have to support the unemployed. Now, but there are further effects. Let's suppose we have, we'll start with highly skilled fields. Let's say there are people displaced from fields such as medicine, and they'll go into other fields which are not as high as medicine, but still of some significance. Let's say some people who would have been physicians instead end up as pharmacists or pharmaceutical company representatives. And let's say that in those areas, their wages are artificially high because of further union activity or licensing activity. So there will be other people who might have been pharmacists or whatever who can't be, and they're displaced to some lower level. And there are unions operating at the lower level. But if the people being displaced are more intelligent, more ambitious than people regularly employed in the other industries, they may well find employment. The more intelligent, more capable people will be able to get jobs at lower levels. But to the extent they do, and those areas are, they have artificially high wage rates, and they can't accommodate everyone who would like to be employed there, who's going to be displaced? the less capable people, they'll be the ones displaced downward. Now, if they're more intelligent than the people in the fields into which they're pushed, there'll be further displacements. Where will the process end?
All the way down the food chain.
You have the greatest displacement at the bottom. The least capable, least qualified people, they'll be the ones forced into unemployment. And if they're not forced into unemployment, they'll have to be employed at abysmally low wages. The pressure of all of the people being pushed down from the top to lower levels is increasing the supply of labor down at the lower levels, and either resulting in substantial unemployment at the lower levels or abysmally low wages at the lower levels. Now, further, what is the effect of the labor unions on worker productivity?
Decreases it.
It almost always operates to decrease it. First of all, how do the unions almost always feel about labor-saving machinery? They oppose it, and they either prevent it or delay it as long as possible. How do they feel about competition among workers? They oppose that. How do they feel about requiring extra people to do the same job? That's what they love. So what is their impact on the productivity of labor, on principle? They're doing their utmost to prevent the rise and to actually reduce the productivity of labor. They're happiest when it takes six men to do one man's job. If they can require six people to do small, minute operations that one person could easily do, that's when they're happiest. Well, what is the effect of that on real wages, if the productivity theory of wages is true? They're actively combating it. Now, the unions are totally unaware of this, because how do they think one goes about raising real wages? What's their method to raise real wages?
Increase the money wage.
They increase the money wage. The unions are focused on money wages, and their idea is we raise the worker's standard of living by increasing the money wages he earns. And the way they accomplish that is they bring about an artificial scarcity of the type of labor that they control. They want to do everything they can to make their type of labor as scarce as possible. If they can get a licensing requirement, they're very happy with that. If they can get a union shop, they're happy with that. Better still, a closed shop. If they can impose long apprenticeship requirements, or simply jack up the wage rates, that will bring about the equivalent of a scarcity, because there'll be just room for fewer people. Now, the reality is that the standard of living does not rise by virtue of people earning more money. That's a fallacy. What is the only thing that can enable the average member of the economy to earn money? What's required for everybody, for the same number of people working, all to earn more money at the same time?
Increase in productivity.
Pardon me? Well, if there's an improvement in the productivity of labor, that will mean more goods. And what will that do to the prices of goods? It'll drop. Is that earning more money for the average wage earner? No. He's earning higher real wages, but he's earning higher real wages by virtue of prices being lower. The only thing that allows the same number of people to earn more money wages is if there's a rise in total payrolls, which in turn depends on an increase in the quantity of money. What allows everybody to earn more money at the same time has no connection with the rise in the standard of living. It's just a purely monetary phenomenon. It's more money. The way the standard of living rises is from the side of goods being produced more efficiently and prices becoming lower. The unions are clueless about this. They don't know how real wages rise, and they do their best to prevent them from rising, because they're doing their best to prevent the rise in the productivity of labor. And they don't realize that when they do this, if, for example, you have the printers union, and the printers union opposed for as long as it could computerized typesetting, for example, they're not aware that in doing such a thing, they're actively combating the rise in real wages. How does computer typesetting serve to raise real wages? Yes, it's more efficient, but how does that connect with a rise in real wages, and whose real wages?
buy the services or the products at times.
Yeah, it's all the buyers of printed matter. The print buyers of printed matter will be able to buy printed matter at a lower price than otherwise, and what's that do to the buying power of their wages, whatever their occupation? It increases. Now, the unions are clueless about this. They don't see how the rise in the productivity of labor raises real wages, because they're not focused on prices coming down. They're focused only on money wages going up. And when they think of productivity, they think that if productivity goes up, that should mean that their money wages should go up. If you show a union that productivity has gone up X percent in their field, they'll say, ah, that justifies our wages going up that percentage. Well, think about this idea. How much has productivity gone up in the making of a megabyte of hard drive storage space? Just think what's happened to the capacity of hard drives. They've gone from low megabytes into high gigabytes, right? Is it taking multitudes more workers to turn out these drives? No, maybe even fewer, or certainly not a substantial difference one way or the other. So what's happened to the productivity of labor in megabytes of hard drive storage space, or megabytes of RAM?
Increased dramatically.
It's increased dramatically. Now, do you think if their wages were tied to this, what kind of earnings should these guys have? They'd all be making tens of millions of dollars a year. Now, it doesn't work that way. Instead, everybody in the economy gets the benefit. The real wages of everybody rises who buys computer hard drives. Now, at the same time, what's happened to the productivity of labor of busboys and waiters? That's been pretty much the same, probably for a couple of centuries. Now, the point here is the productivity of labor as relating to real wages does not work industry by industry. There's a general productivity of labor, and it operates to raise real wages throughout the whole economy. How does the rise in the productivity of labor serve to raise the real wages of busboys and waiters? Because their buying power will rise. You see, what's going on is, if we didn't have the increase in the quantity of money, the rise in the productivity of labor would be reducing the prices of whatever busboys and waiters bought, and that would raise their real wages. With the increase in the quantity of money, what happens to the demand for the labor of the busboys and waiters? That goes up, and so their money wages rise. But because of the rise in productivity of labor, the prices of what they buy does not rise as much. All right, I'll close this discussion by trying to reconcile what might be a troubling point. I'm telling you that real wages rise not from the side of people earning more money, but from the side of prices going down. Nevertheless, at the level of personal experience, it may appear, and with good reason does appear, that the way an individual improves his standard of living is by earning more money. If you stop and you ask yourself, what can you do alone to raise your standard of living? I think the obvious answer is you need to go and earn more money, right? Now, most people, what they do is they invalidly generalize from something that is true of a given individual or any given individual, and they assume that this is the same principle across the economy as a whole, and it isn't. Let's look closer at what it is that enables an individual to earn more money and what connection it has with productivity. The reason people think that a rise in productivity goes with earning more money is because that's what's true for an individual. Here you are, you're in an MBA program. Well, why are you in it? Okay, you're interested in making more money, and presumably going through the program will increase your knowledge and skills and make you more productive. And so here we are. Isn't this an example? You're becoming more productive, you earn more money. Well, yes and no. There's actually something else that's present, which is hidden behind your being more productive and earning more money. And that is, the element that's enabling you to earn more money when you become more productive is that you're becoming relatively more productive to those with whom you compete. See, let's say there's a position opening in your firm and you want to be considered for promotion. Well, maybe if you have an MBA, you have a better shot at it. You can be promoted, you'll earn more money. But what if other people in your firm who might also be considered, suppose they're in MBA programs too, and just as good ones? Well, then does your having the MBA guarantee that you're going to earn more money?
No.
Suppose it becomes the general practice for people seeking to work in business to have an MBA. Will having an MBA be the source of a higher income, or won't it be a basic requirement? It's a basic requirement. Now, see, what happens when an individual improves his productivity, the odds are that not everyone is doing the same thing at the same time. The odds are, in a given case, that he will improve his productivity, not merely absolutely, but relative to the productivity of those with whom he competes. And if he does that, then what happens to his ability to earn more money? Then he will earn more money. But what happens to the ability to earn more money of the other people who he is now a stronger competitor with? Their ability to earn more money is reduced. Now, let's say everyone is improving his productivity. Everyone is becoming more productive. If they're all becoming more productive to the same degree, will they earn more money?
No.
No, but what will be the nature of the benefit? There'll still be a benefit.
Productivity will go up.
Productivity reduction.
There'll be a rise in productivity and prices will fall, and everyone, even though earning the same money, the money will buy more. Now, of course, at the same time, there may be more money, and people earn more money just because there's more money. But the real issue is that productivity is a source of earning more money for individuals in competition with other individuals, and they earn more money to the extent that their improved productivity enhances their competitive position. But it's not the source of higher money earnings overall. The real way the standard of living goes up for everybody is by means of prices being less than they otherwise would. Okay, we've reached our usual limit. I hope you'll all be here promptly at 6 o'clock next week.